Hello, and welcome to Block 2 of A342, Central Questions in the Study of Music. I'm Catherine Tackley, and with me today are two of the other authors of this block, David Rowland and Martin Clark.
Hi.
Hello.
Block 2 is entitled The Transmission of Music and explores how and in what forms music moves between people, composers, performers, listeners, editors, and community members. In looking at the transmission, or what is sometimes called the mediation of music, we've considered not only how music moves between people, but also how this affects our experience of music. As a way into this question, we'll consider a familiar piece of music, the air from J.S. Bach's Third Orchestral Suite, which is sometimes called the air on the G string. We'll start by considering what the surviving manuscripts from the composer's time tell us, or perhaps don't tell us, about how this piece might be performed. David, could you tell us something about those?
Yeah. The air from Bach's Suite No. 3 may seem like a straightforward piece, but it has a complex history. We don't know exactly when it was composed, and Bach's original score no longer exists. In fact, the only sources in Bach's handwriting are the first violin and continuo parts, which he must have written for one of the early performances of the work. Editors therefore have to reconstruct the score from these parts, as well as instrumental parts written out by his son, Carl Philipp Emanuel, and other 18th century musicians. The problems involved in determining how J.S. Bach might have imagined this air sounding don't end there. In an important source that was written out by Christian Friedrich Penzel, a student who studied at the school where Bach taught, some sections of the violin part from the suite from which the air is taken are marked to be played solo. At least, that's what the markings seem to imply. They include the whole of the air. So, if the top line of the air is played by just one player, how many performers should play the second violin, viola, and bass parts? Unfortunately, the sources don't really help us with this question, and musicians approach the piece in various ways. For instance, the recording of the work by Trevor Pinnock in the English Concert features a solo violinist, but there are more players on the other string parts. When slow, lyrical music of this period was played by a single performer, it was usual for that person to add some ornaments of their own, particularly when a section was repeated. And Simon Standage does just this in the English Concert recording. The air is written in two halves, each of which is repeated, so there's plenty of scope here for the performer to add some material. At the time Bach composed this air, bass parts were usually played by a melody instrument, such as the cello, as well as a chord-playing instrument, such as a harpsichord. And it was typical that the keyboardist would improvise harmonies above the bass line. These had to fit in with what the other parts were playing, so a form of notational shorthand, consisting of numbers, was written above or below the bass line to let the keyboardist know what harmonies to play. And the system of notation is known as figured bass. Interestingly, the bass part of the air is not figured. In fact, there's no figuring for the whole suite from which the air is taken. So what was expected of the keyboard player who usually played the bass part? Perhaps there was no keyboard player, at least for some performances. Or perhaps the keyboard player simply made up a part based on the sounds of the other instruments. As you can see, there's a great deal that we don't know. And the work has been recorded in a range of interpretations, some with keyboard and some without. Catherine, can you tell us more about the recordings of Bach's air?
Yeah, there's plenty to say there. Because, like many familiar and well-loved pieces of classical music, Bach's air has not only continued to be performed live, but has an extensive recorded history stretching right back to the early 20th century. Today, there are books, radio programmes and websites all devoted to guiding listeners through the huge variety of recorded interpretations of the piece. These include performances which aim to recreate how the piece would have sounded in Bach's day, based on research, drawing on original manuscript sources and using instruments from the period. At the other extreme, the piece has been adapted and recorded in ways which foreground the individuality of particular performers. In fact, this trend predates the development of commercial recording technology. In an 1871 arrangement of the movement for solo violin and piano, a large proportion of the melody is performed on the lowest string of the violin, which has a particularly rich tone, leading to the nickname Air on the G String, which is frequently used today instead of the work's original title. More recent versions of the piece have become more widely known through recordings rather than sheet music. In the 1960s, the French jazz pianist Jacques Lussier used Bach's Air as a basis for jazz improvisation, which is a way of performing that is actually quite similar to the way musicians approach these pieces in the Baroque. This track was used in television adverts for Hamlet cigars for more than 30 years, an association which has remained a powerful influence on the way in which this piece is understood and recognised within popular culture. One of the transformations affected in Lussier's version of the Air is that the melodic material is played by a pianist rather than a violinist. In fact, there exist a few other keyboard versions of the Air. So one of the central questions posed in this module is what music does, a question that often involves thinking about how music reflects the context for which it's intended. Martin, could you say a few words about that?
Well, as we've heard already, this piece gained considerable popularity in the arrangement by August Wilhelmy, titled Air on the G String. It's also been arranged and transcribed for many other instruments and ensembles, and has been featured in lots of films, TV programmes and adverts too. I think it's interesting to consider how the intended function of these arrangements affect the ways in which they're mediated. I remember learning this piece as a child when I was just setting out as a pianist, from a book called Learn to Play Easy Piano Classics. Looking back at it now, and comparing it with the original version, it's clear that the texture's been considerably reduced, aspects of both violin parts have been combined into a single melody line, some notes have been transposed an octave lower to avoid using lots of ledger lines, and some of the octave leaps in the bass have been omitted. While these decisions might seem to undermine the integrity of Bach's music, they're unlikely to be important considerations for the intended users of this arrangement. This arrangement is a mediation intended to make the work accessible to performers of modest ability. I remember as a young pianist enjoying being able to play a staple of the classical musical canon. For the older beginner, it might be a way of allowing them to perform a piece that they've enjoyed listening to. On the other hand, Siegfried Kargeller's organ transcription and Max Reger's version for piano duet need to be understood as mediating the work for different publics in different contexts. In part, Reger's version has a similar aim to the Easy Play one, in making staples of orchestral repertoire accessible for domestic music making, albeit by more skilled performers in this case. Kargeller's, though, is intended for concert performance, and reflects the common trend of including orchestral transcriptions in organ recitals in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. For many audience members, this was the main way in which they were able to hear orchestral repertoire.
Thanks, Martin and David. I think that gives us a really good idea about some of the themes that we'll explore further in the module.
Thank you.